We are bringing together imperfect people in pursuit of a whole life. Welcome to the Pathfinder Church Message Podcast. This week, Pastor Dion shares his message from How to Lose an Enemy in 10 Days, The Danger of Blind Spots.
Last night when I rolled up here for church, it was warm yesterday. It was a nice day. It was like 85 degrees or something. And as I'm walking onto campus at 3 o'clock, I see Brendan Schmidt, our tech director, with some of our volunteers who are actually here also again this morning, on one of our roofs hanging Christmas lights. It's kind of like, felt a little juxtaposed, but it was also like, yeah, that's coming really soon, which is exciting. The holidays are coming soon. We have the warmth of Thanksgiving coming, the joy of Christmas, all of the good feels. But before we can get to all of that, we've got another national holiday that we have to contend with, Election Day. Yeah, and this one's a doozy, right? We got a big presidential election. There's Senate elections that are contested and hot all over the country. And then there are these other issues that are up on ballots, local ballots like ours here in Missouri, or state ballots like ours here in Missouri, that are really, really contentious issues. Lots of people are really passionate. And so I can't wait. Do you remember when you used to get a text message and you're actually excited because you thought it might be someone you know? Not just like, you know, someone telling you to do something politically, but one of the questions that we have this time of year often is, so what does a Christian do with all of this? As a Christian, how should you vote? And I've been asked that question so many times that today I just decided I'm going to tell you. So hopefully you brought your paper and your pen, and I'm going to give you the complete voting. Glad most of you know that I'm joking. We don't do that here for a couple of reasons. The first reason is we see in Jesus' ministry, if you read the Gospels, you'll see this, that people were trying to get him to take a stand on all kinds of hot button moral and political issues of the day. And Jesus, he resists taking stances on those things. Like, he doesn't let people pin him down because Jesus' focus is on one thing. It's on what we've been singing about today. It's on the kingdom of God and inviting people into it, reconciling people into the family of God. That's his whole focus. And so we think if that's good enough for Jesus, that's good enough for us. But there's also a more practical reason that we don't, you know, like weigh in and give you like the answers on who you should vote for. And that is that morality is more complex than what we often want to admit. And I'm not saying that morality is relative. That's not what I'm saying at all. That's something entirely different. But even in moments when you feel like you have a simple and clear moral choice, the reality is that morality is a little more complicated than that. And so good Christians, faithful people, can disagree on how to apply their morality to all kinds of life issues. If that makes you feel uncomfortable, I understand. It certainly would have made me feel uncomfortable just a couple of years ago. But one of the things that's helped me along is what we see here in Matthew chapter 12. We're going to look at an encounter between Jesus and some of the Pharisees. And by the way, the Pharisees, we kind of talk about these guys, if you're in church, as like they're just the bad guys. I want you to remember that the Pharisees were, what drove them was an intense desire to be faithful to the commands, to the culture that God had established. So although they got a little off track, their hearts were set completely on faithfulness to the moral law. So at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry, and they began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. You got this picture? It's a Sabbath, they're on a short walk, they're going through the grain fields, these guys are hungry, and so they're picking heads of grain and like grapes at the supermarket. Which, by the way, I had a guy at Schnucks tell me the other day, like he was doing it himself, he worked there. And he's like, this is okay to do, by the way. And so I was like, okay, all right, it's okay to do. It's not stealing. So his disciples are doing this. They're eating a little snack on the Sabbath, though. And notice this, when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath. Now, we may not understand everything about Sabbath laws, but I'll tell you that the Pharisees are technically right. That the Sabbath laws, I mean, there was just a whole body of laws about what you were not allowed to do on the Sabbath. You couldn't walk very far. You couldn't cook elaborate meals. You couldn't do any work. They're all derived from Exodus 34, by the way. 6 days you shall labor, but on the seventh day you shall rest. Even during plowing season and harvest, you must rest. And so there was interpretation of this passage of scripture that said you weren't even allowed to pluck the head of a flower on Sabbath because that would be akin to reaping or harvesting crops. And this was really well established. This was very clear that you weren't allowed to do these things. And yet here Jesus' disciples are, and they're flagrantly breaking the Sabbath law. The Pharisees are technically right. Now, if you're looking at this and you're going, wait a minute. How do you get that you can't pluck the, this is talking about something different, right? Well, not only do the Pharisees have this verse on their side, but in Numbers 15, this is back in the days of Moses, a man is found gathering sticks to make a fire on the Sabbath. And the man, they say this is a crime, and the man's brought before Moses, and Moses consults God himself, and God says that the punishment for that man for gathering sticks on the Sabbath is to be put to death. That was the punishment. They put him to death for gathering sticks on the Sabbath. So I know this seems weird to us, but in Jesus' day, this was really clear. And the Pharisees, they're spot on here that what the disciples are doing is technically unlawful. They've got Exodus 34, they have Numbers 15, and a precedent that God himself had established backing them up. So what do you have to say for yourself, Jesus? Well, he's always got something to say. So Jesus answered, haven't you read what King David did when he and his companions were hungry? And you might not know the story, but he's referring to a part of the Old Testament scriptures. David entered the house of God, and he and his companions, they were on the run. They didn't have any food. They ate the consecrated bread, the special bread that was not lawful for anyone to eat except only for the priest. So remember that? Or haven't you read in the law that the priests on Sabbath duty in the temple, they technically desecrate the Sabbath, and yet they're innocent, right? Because you're not allowed to work on the Sabbath, and except the priests have to work on the Sabbath. And so he says, oh, but those guys, they get an exception. So what Jesus says now is, he says, you know what? First off, please know that even in the moral law, in this very clear moral law, God himself makes exceptions. There's a law that's given, he doesn't hold David accountable for a crime when David goes and eats this consecrated bread that no one is allowed to eat except the priests. There's a reason for God making that exception, and God makes an exception to these priests. So God himself establishes, or he permits exceptions. So he says this isn't as clear and decisive as you might think. And then he goes into a second argument. That's just his first argument. A second argument's here. He says, I tell you that something greater than the temple is here. So his first argument, hey, God himself makes exceptions. His second argument says, and by the way, God is doing a new thing. If the temple is the place on earth where God's glory is manifest and where people can go to meet with God, Jesus says, well, I'm telling you, God is about to upstage that temple and do something even greater, because now it's no longer a building that manifests the glory of God. It's no longer a building that people will go to access God's presence. Jesus says, now through me, the glory of God will dwell, and I am the one that people will come to find their way to the Father. And so if I'm about to upstage the temple, which he is, then everything that's connected with the temple, all of these rules and regulations and Sabbath regulations, Jesus says, all of those things are passing away and they're about to change. This is a deep theological argument that I'm not sure the Pharisees fully understood. I'm sure it upset them. Maybe we're still getting our minds around this, but it's powerful. That's a second argument, but he's not done. All right, don't question Jesus. He's gonna give you some rationale. And so he's got a third argument. And here's what you should know, that in the legal system of ancient Israel, you weren't even to entertain an accusation against someone without two or three witnesses. And also by two or three witnesses, if you had three people testifying to your innocence, it was pretty clear. It was clear that you're innocent. So Jesus is calling upon three witnesses here. Saw the first, the second. Now here's the third. He's calling on an Old Testament witness, the prophet Hosea, and how God spoke through him. And he says to the Pharisees, if you had known what these words mean, this is from Hosea 6:6, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So his third witness is Hosea 6:6. And this is really interesting. A direct quote from Hosea 6:6. This is really interesting. Because what Jesus is saying here is that sometimes there's a hierarchy to our morals or our values. Right, you look at mercy and sacrifice, and does God care about both those things? What do you think? Does God care about mercy and sacrifice? I think so. I mean, we talk this way all the time. We talk about making sacrifices for the greater good. We talk about how God offered his son as a fragrant sacrifice for us all. God cares about sacrifice. He cares about mercy. But here we find out that when push comes to shove, God will always put mercy, and this is a deep concept in Hebrew. I wish I could talk about it. Chesed is the word. He puts mercy over sacrifice. They're both good things, but if they come into conflict with each other and we have to choose one over the other, we find out here that God will always put mercy over sacrifice. There's a hierarchy or an order to our morality. And I wish that we had a, you know, kind of a matrix throughout the rest of the Bible which does this for all the things. We don't. We just know that mercy's better than sacrifice. Three different answers, three different witnesses, and what Jesus is showing us is that a clear moral issue. I mean, these guys are violating the Sabbath law. How can they even call themselves true believers? And again, this seems silly to us, but it would have been so clear to the ancient Israelites. This is a flagrant violation of everything that's decent and holy. So how can something so clear, Jesus says, actually, it's not as clear as you might think. Morality can often be more complex than we think. And then Jesus, because he doesn't just talk about things, he's the Word made flesh, and I love this about Jesus. So after he talks about something, he usually embodies that action and he shows us. That's why he's a way better preacher than me for lots of reasons, but also this one, because he gives a nice message and he gives three defenses, but then he does this going on from that place. He went into their synagogue, and again, still the Sabbath, and a man with a shriveled hand was there and looking for a reason to bring charges against Jesus, because remember that the charges before were not against Jesus, they were against his disciples. And now they want to put Jesus in the hot seat. So looking for a reason to bring a charge against Jesus, they use this poor man who's suffering with a disability, they use him as a pawn, and they ask Jesus, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Again, what's the answer? I just told you all about Sabbath law. What's the answer, technically? No, you can't do that. It's work. It's not allowed, especially if your work is to be a healer. It's not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to do that. Look at how Jesus answers. He said to them, okay, if any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, are you just gonna leave it there for a day? No, of course not. Will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a person than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Then he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And so he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus. Again, it's an amazing story, and you see the compassion and the love of Jesus, but I don't want you to miss the presenting issue here, that on a clear issue of morality, something that everybody in Israel thought would have been really, really clear, you keep the Sabbath, you keep the Sabbath, you keep the Sabbath. Jesus flagrantly breaks the Sabbath law, the letter of the Sabbath law, in order to achieve a higher good. It is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. God desires mercy over sacrifice. And it's very provocative. But this is what's telling. This is what I want you to notice. That in response to this whole thing, in response to this disagreement, notice the Pharisees' reaction. They decide they've got to kill him. Now, there are a lot of good responses to this. I mean, if I were living at this time and I'm sure I would have been confused like the Pharisees were. And maybe I would have asked for more clarity from Jesus. Or maybe I would have taken some time to go home and pray and study the scriptures and to say, can this be right? I mean, there's a lot of actions. But this action is telling that in response to Jesus' challenge to what they think is so clear morally, the reaction is not to do those other things. The reaction is, we got to kill this guy. It escalates pretty quickly, doesn't it? And yet it's not surprising, is it? It seems that when we talk about enemies, and over the last few weeks we've talked about enemies, enemies may seem strong to you in lots of senses. I don't have enemies, you know, like, and we've talked about that, but it seems that when we think about enemies or categories of enemies, we save our vitriol and our most white hot hatred for enemies under this category, enemies that we would call moral or ideological enemies. The people who disagree with us on issues that we are very passionate about. Or people who feel to us like a threat to deeply held values or ideas or our way of life or to our future or to our family's future. Moral or ideological enemies. More than any other kind of enemies, these are the enemies that we feel justified in retaliating against, where the ends justifies the means. And that's because I think we understand that moral ideas or values or beliefs, they're not just ideas, they actually become reality. And so some of these ideas, they're so threatening. And when we're talking about our moral or ideological enemies, it is true that they may be threatening. It's not just paranoia. In fact, the Pharisees are right. Jesus is about to turn upside down their whole moral system, their whole culture, their whole religion, their whole place in the hierarchy. They have a right to feel threatened. Jesus is threatening deeply everything that they know and believe and trust in. But even though we may feel threatened deeply by the ideas that someone else holds, Jesus is helping us see that we are not entitled, we are not justified to pour out our hatred or our vitriol on them. Just think about what's going on in our country right now with all the, you know, division that we have, strong moral ideological divides in our country, or at least that's what they say, but it's motivating all of this really just like awful language and hatred and even violence. And if we feel justified, because the stakes are that high, we're not just dealing with issues, we're dealing with morality here. If we feel justified to respond that way, then here's what I want you to notice. So did the Pharisees. And as a result of their certainty, they took the perfect, righteous, holy Son of God, and they put him on trial. And after the trial, declared him to be guilty of violating God's law. God himself, they put God on trial and convicted him of violating God's law. And then they didn't stop there. They put him to death because they were so sure that he was the enemy. They were so blinded by their own morality and their own ideology. This is a cautionary tale for all of us. And Jesus is showing us a different way. We're going to look at a different way, and I'm going to try to go through this quickly, so I keep moving and not get bogged down. Here's the different way of Jesus. When we're dealing with our moral or ideological enemies, first, don't attack them. Instead, let them teach you specifically about your blind spots, about your blind spots. I'll start here with the first part. Don't attack them. All throughout this series, we've been learning that Jesus calls us to deal with our enemies differently than the rest of the world. And this is true even of our moral or ideological enemies. In Matthew 5, here's kind of the theme verse for all of this. This is the clear word of Jesus. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Jesus says it makes sense to love your neighbor, the people who agree with you, the people who are on your team, the people who are on your side, the people who hold your values, and to hate everyone else who stands against you. But Jesus says, hey, even in the case of moral or ideological enemies, I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Now, this is the way of Jesus, not only telling us how to do this, but this is exactly what Jesus does for us. And that's what we need to realize first. That the Bible says that even though we try to be friends of God and we're here on a Sunday morning at church, the reality is that so often we are, and once we were, and some days we still are, the enemies of God. When you think about God advancing his kingdom, his agenda for this world, often the reality is, even though we have good intentions, we are the people who are standing in the way of God accomplishing what he wants to accomplish in this world. We are obstacles. We are barriers for him. And of course, he can deal with that because he's God, but we just got to look at ourselves. Even though we're trying to do the right thing, sometimes we are the very things that are getting in the way of God's greater unfolding love and the kingdom expanding in our world. It's us. We are enemies of God. And yet Jesus doesn't treat us in the way that people treat enemies. In spite of the fact that we were once enemies and someday still are adversaries to the work of God unfolding in this world, Jesus loves us. Not just with words, but action. And that's just what I just need everyone to know today. Because sometimes you question, like, am I beyond the love of God? How could God love someone like me? This is a reminder that God is able to love you even if you are his worst, most diametrically opposed enemy. He doesn't treat you like we treat our enemies. He treats you, even if you're an enemy, he treats you with love. When we're dangerous to his agenda, when we're dangerous to the people, other people he loves us. And it's powerful when you realize that. There's nothing you can do to disqualify yourself from the love of God. Even when we are enemies, he still loves us. That'll change your life if you let it, if you just let it in, if you believe it, if you receive it. But I hope it also changes your life in another way. I hope it encourages you to go and do likewise. Now here's what I know over the series, because I've felt this within myself. Awesome messages so far in the series. And everything's true. And in my head, as I'm listening to these messages, I'm like, yeah, that's right. But sometimes in my heart, there's just this barrier, right? It's like, love your enemies. And I'm like, yeah, that's so true. I need to. And then I try to. And it's like my heart runs into a brick wall. What Jesus is telling us here is that loving your enemies isn't just about warm fuzzies. It's not about all the good feels towards someone. That's not what this is about. But he gives us the shortcut. If you're stuck, if you can't figure out how to move forward, he says, pray. Not just pray for yourself, but pray for your enemies. And I'll tell you this, maybe it sounds exaggerated that you could lose an enemy in 10 days, but I think if you tried to pray for your enemy, the person that you just can't move past what they did or the threat that they are to you, if you just prayed for them for 10 days, I think you would notice a significant difference. You'd see something loosen within your being, and maybe they would seem less like an enemy, or maybe you'd start to cultivate more love for them. Didn't I say I was going to go quick? I got to keep going. All right. So don't attack them. The first thing is just like, don't do what we normally do with our enemies, even when they feel like a grave and moral threat to us. The second part, let them teach you. I would go out on a limb and say that I think for most people, we'd still say that Abraham Lincoln is the greatest president that we ever had. And the reason I would say that is because any state you travel to, they're trying to claim something about Lincoln, right? They're like, Lincoln once took a nap here. And that's like their state motto. It's that big of a deal. And Abraham Lincoln, he is incredible. He did something that no one in our divided nation is willing to do today. One of the things that you know, if you know about Lincoln, is he created a cabinet of rivals, of people who were ideologically opposed to him and to what he thought was best for the nation. He brought some of those people around him and they became his cabinet. And it's not just shrewd because, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. It's important to do. It's humble, but it's important to do because you may actually learn from them. I don't think we consider this possibility very often, that our enemies have something to teach us, especially our moral or ideological enemies, that they might actually have something to teach us. Because in the most part, we think we're intellectually or morally superior to those people. They have nothing to teach us. Steve Howard, the senior pastor here for a lot of years and my mentor for a lot of years, used to say, I can learn something from anybody. Because I used to be worried about like, oh, can I read that person's book? Their thinking might poison my mind. And he was just kind of like, you know, eat the fish, spit out the bones. You can learn something from anyone. And that sounds good again, but in your life, does that apply even to your enemies? Can you imagine trying to learn something from your greatest moral or ideological enemies? Now, I'll be honest, I was trying this on this week, and I'm like, this sounds good. Again, like a lot of stuff in this series sounds good, but I'm like, is it true? Is that real? Can I actually do that? And then last Saturday, I got this really unfortunate real-life example of this. So if you missed this news, I doubt you did if you're here in St. Louis, but last Saturday, this is an overpass over Interstate 270 not far from here. There was this scene that was happening. Men with masks, America for the white man, swastikas there on a highway overpass. Here's another view of that. And one of my kids told me about this first because they saw it somewhere on social media or something. And we're all permitted to feel different things about different stuff. But I'll just tell you, when I saw this in my community, we have to be careful about the feeling of disgust. But when I saw this in my community, I just felt a deep disgust. And all I wanted to do was to get these guys out of here. I'm like, get them out. Put them on a small boat in the middle of a big ocean surrounded by sharks. Just let them figure it out. Like, I don't want them here. I don't want them here because this scares me. It scares me. And here I am. I'm a white male, and this scares me. It scares me for the future of our country. It scares me for people that I love and care about who are not white males. And I can only imagine how, for those of you who are not white males, how this might feel for you. And so my reaction is just like, no way, not in my community. And then I tried this on, like, okay, is there something I could learn from these guys? And all week I'm just like, I don't know. And then I was inspired. I read this news story from News Channel 5. It was a follow-up story about a Jewish woman named Shelley Dean. And I'm going to read part of that story to you. It says, Saturday morning, Dean heard that there were red and black flags with swastikas at the overpass, but didn't realize people were there. When she drove up, she questioned their chants and asked what they were saying. They were chanting, non-white parasite, and America for the white man. The group was also saying other racist language, and they were doing the Hitler salute. She kept asking questions, though, and soon one of them welcomed her to come over. They said, I mean, if you want to, come up here and talk to us. She responded, I kind of do. By the way, Dean works at an organization dedicated to providing Jewish education, and she's a yoga instructor at a Jewish community center. We say peace begins with me, Dean shared. This is the mantra that motivated her. The first thing I said to them was, am I safe because I'm Jewish? And one of the guys said, yes. But before her eyes, they were saying, Hail Hitler, and denying the Holocaust. But one of the things they also said was that they were only using Nazi symbols because they know it gets people going. Dean also asked the group to show their faces. I did ask them to take off their masks on numerous times, but they said they would lose their jobs or couldn't open bank accounts if they were discovered to be who they were. But I said, if you feel so confident about what you're doing, why don't you want to show pride and stand behind it? Well, one of the guys said, this isn't pride. It's about educating. She asked if they want to hurt the groups they were verbally denouncing. Their response, no, we just want them to leave. She also asked the men, if they have ever met anyone Jewish. Their answer was, no. So at the end, she said, remember, today, you met a nice Jewish girl. And one man responded, I'll remember that. I so admire and respect a person like this, a woman like this, who's, you know, like being attacked by these messages, who could walk up and be genuinely curious. It's just amazing to me. And it reminds me of what AJ shared last week about Daryl Davis, the jazz artist who, remember this, talking to help 200 KKK members leave the KKK because he was genuinely open and curious. Can you learn even from your enemies? Sometimes there'll be a learning, if you're curious, that will enable you to help change their thinking. Right? You'll walk away going, hey, have you ever met anyone Jewish? Well, today you met somebody, and now this is no longer just some villainous thing that you don't understand. You have flesh and blood behind this people group that you hate. Like, she learned that about them, and she was able to offer them something that would help move them, right? That's somehow, sometimes how our learning will go. We'll let our enemies teach us about what it is we need to bring to them to help them grow. And then other times, you'll learn something that will help you grow. It's different kinds of learning, but I think one of the best kinds of learning for us is the final thing. A new approach to our moral and ideological enemies, don't attack them, let them teach you about your blind spots. Let's call this out again with Jesus and the Pharisees. The Pharisees' whole desire was faithfulness. Their whole movement was based on faithfulness to the moral laws of God. So how could they end up so far away from Jesus? Well, it happens all the time. This week, I found this. It's a little blurry, but this was someone else's. This is a map, a matrix of what someone found to be all of the Bible's values. Now, I'm not attesting for its completion. I would never even attempt to do this. It'd be way too tedious for me. I don't have the attention span for that. But you can look up there and you can see lots of words that you're like, oh yeah, that's a biblical value. And maybe there's some missing, but I think the ones that are up there are certainly biblical values. As we look at these values, though, here's what I realize, that some of those words will jump out to you more than others. By the way, on stream, make sure that they get to see this at home too. Some of these values may jump out more than others. And the ones that jump out, they're kind of like, oh yeah, yeah, that's a good one. Spoiler alert, they're all good ones if they're biblical. But there's some that we look at and we're like, yeah, 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 that's a good one. That's either because it's a pet value, because it's something that we just kind of do easily or naturally. There are some things that we're just kind of wired to do or we are taught to do, and it's pretty easy for us, and we kind of look at other people and you're like, I don't know why anyone would struggle with the opposite of this thing. It's just so easy and obvious, right? There are pet moral values for us. And then there are other pet moral values for us that come the opposite way. They're pet values that we really notice because we have spent our entire lives trying to cultivate them. And so we reason, and there are some words up here, I'm not going to tell you which ones. There's some words up here that for me, they jump out to me because, like, I have spent 47 years of my life trying to cultivate those values, and I've done a pretty good job. And I say, if I can do it, so can you. And so when we look at lists of biblical values, again, all good things, some jump out to us and we tend to give them a higher value. And you know, within the body of Christ, maybe that's a good thing if we have humility with those things. But then here's what happens, that even all of these good moral values, these biblical things, there are moments in our life where they will come into conflict with each other. If you look up there in the top, very top right, there's the word peace and underneath it, justice. Both biblical values. And yet I can think of lots of moments in my life where the value for peace and the value for justice come into conflict. And there are some of us here today who, when those things come into conflict, will be justice. Like, that's what's coming first. No justice, no peace. And there are some of us who say, no, peace, peace at all costs, no matter what. We gotta have peace. And the reality is that whichever side you're on, you'll probably villainize the other side for being part of the problem. See, even with biblical values, there are moments where they come into conflict and we've got to make decisions. But here's another way to deal with those conflict moments. Instead of demonizing the other side, it's an opportunity for us to look at the other side and maybe let them teach us about something that may be a blind spot in our own lives. So if I'm someone who always cries out for justice when justice and peace come into conflict, instead of demonizing the other side for being soft or not caring enough about justice, maybe I can look at them and go, Lord, do I not value peace enough? Is this a blind spot for me? Do I not see the value and the benefit of living with the Spirit of peace? Or if for me, I've got a lot of Enneagram 1 energy in me, for those of you who know what that means, a lot of focus towards justice and fairness and what's right and what's ethical. And if I look at the other side who just wants peace and I think they're a bunch of cowards and they're not standing on biblical values, instead, can I use that, those other people, to say, you know what, could it be, right? Could it be that, right, you get this, vice versa? Could it be I don't value peace enough? Could it be that I don't value justice enough? Could it be that I have a blind spot in my life? See, the irritation, the conflict that often makes us want to castigate someone as a moral enemy, what those things are often doing are the revealing blind spots to you. Because this is hard to hold all together. And sometimes the people who feel the most threatening to you are just people who are helping you see that there might be something missing in your moral framework that you need to pay a little more attention to. And let me tell you, the risk, the danger of going through life just going, no, I'm fine, the danger of going through life with blind spots, it's this. Going through life with blind spots, this is how good people who start off their journey trying to just be godly end up being Pharisees. See, Jesus gives us, and I'm going to close with this, Jesus gives us one final word of wisdom, and this is just, man, if you can take this in, it's really well known, but if you can live by this, you'll be well on your way to living a God-pleasing life morally. Jesus says, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? I love Jesus says, why do you do this and how do you do this? I'll tell you this, it happens whenever we stop listening and learning from people who see the world differently than we do. How do we become like Pharisees? It happens whenever I care more about what's wrong with someone else's vision of morality than what might be wrong with my own. I have so much more that I would love to say about this, and we are absolutely out of time. All in favor of making church 2 hours? Oh, definitely motion not carried. Okay, instead of that, let's stop talking. Let's do this thing that Jesus tells us to do. And so here's what I want you to do. I want you to take a moment and just close your eyes. Because in life, it's easy to look at what's wrong with everyone else's vision, everyone else's ideology, everyone else's values. It's easy to assume that those people are the problem. And maybe they are, and maybe there's some threatening things. But Jesus tells us, even if that's true, we always must look at ourselves first. If there's a speck in someone else's eye, that means there's a plank in our eye. So right now, in a moment of quiet, just talking to your Father in heaven, Ask God to show you your blind spots. Help him, ask him to help you see. Ask him to help you see the plank that might be in your eye. And if you don't have words for it, it's just that simple. Father in heaven, God in heaven, please show me my blind spot. Show me the plank that's in my eye. Help me see it. Just go ahead and talk to your Father on your own right now. Pay attention. If he brings something to mind, if the Holy Spirit prompts an answer, pay attention to it. And the second thing I want you to spend time in prayer with your Father is just praying for forgiveness. As much as we're concerned about the other side being wrong, there's plenty of wrong in each of us. And as we just heard, that even if we are complete enemies of God, he loves us. So talk to your Father right now with no fear and ask for forgiveness. And it can be as simple as just saying, God in heaven, Father in heaven, for the sins I know, for the sins I don't know, forgive me. I'm just going to ask you to stay there in that place of examination. I'm going to invite the band back out. Stay there in that place as we sing this next song.
Thanks for listening to the Pathfinder Church Message Podcast. If you'd like to hear more messages like this, hit the subscribe button. You can also find more resources at our website, pathfinderstl.org.